gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome to the Stephanie Miller Show. Good morning to you. Brought to you by Mercedes-Benz Certified Pre-Owned Vehicles. Certified Affordable Luxury. See how professionally I did that? And Tony, you thought I would screw it up. Oh, ye of little faith. I'm Hal Sparks. It's my final day this week of filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they've been away on vacation, and a much-earned one it has been. And we are more than happy to have them returning next week, and not just because I need the sleep. Let's be completely honest. Special circumstances this morning. I feel like I have to catch some of you up in case you have you caught some of the tweets that were flying late last night. But I did the show yesterday from Vegas, and then had a show last night in Vegas at the Shimmer Ballroom and at the Hilton Casino as part of the Icons of Comedy series that I'm performing in. It's sort of a regular residency that I'm doing fairly regularly, and not completely regular, but then that's my idiom. And I will be back there in May at the end of the month for Memorial Day weekend. So if you're thinking about going out to Vegas, that's a good time to go. So I'm doing the Shimmer Ballroom. It's a fantastic venue. It's really a lot of fun. There's a lot of history in that place because that's where Elvis was performing. And there's a couple of great shows in there. Greg London, who does impressions that rock, is what his show's called. And then there's Trent Carlini, the Aces Elvis impersonator, who's won, I guess, the next big thing or whatever that show was. Regardless, good shows going on. Nice place. End of story. This week, so I did some press the last time I did it, and there's a little bit of a delay. So you do a press article, and then it takes a couple of weeks for it to get hit print and all that. And the people who did the article decided to come to my show. They had not seen me perform live. We'd had an interview, but they didn't get to come down last week, so they decided to come down. And in the middle of my show, Vince Neil, the lead singer of Motley Crue. Actually, right as I was coming on stage, I do this big kind of entrance because it's Vegas, where this big curtain goes up as we're playing music or whatever, and I change it up. But last night it was Gene Simmons' version of Firestarter, actually, which is pretty much a dead-on remake. But I'm standing there, and the curtain's going up, and apparently there were some F-bombs thrown. Vince got a little pokey with two of the females there, poking them in the shoulder and in the chest, and so much so that one of them ended up with a nice bruise on her shoulder, which is, for the record, completely uncool and loserish. And he left the room before the curtain got up where I could see him. He just kind of, I guess you don't really want to be standing on the floor when a comedian watches you publicly dismantle your standing with the community. But so he came in right at the tail end of my buddy Chris Bono's act. He just kind of stormed in just as he was introducing me as the music was playing, yelled some F-bombs, poke, poke, and then screams a little bit and walks out just as the curtain's going up. So music's playing really loud. I don't hear it. And we, eventually comes out during the course of my show, and I joke about it as I am wont to do and is important for me to do. And so midway through my show, the police show up and take the two people that were sitting in the audience that he had this altercation with out for statements, as well as three or four other members of the audience. And then by the end of the show, I'm finding out that they basically have an APB out on Vince Neil. He's somewhere in the hotel, and they can't find him. He owns a restaurant in there called Trace Rio's Cantina, which the restaurant part always seems to be closed. The only part that always that is open is the bar. The restaurant, there's just no one in there serving anything, and I don't know if that's a mistake or a sign of good judgment. I've never had the food. So that was fun. But the plan was, last night, I'm going to finish my show, immediately run off stage, do my little meet and greet, glad hand with people, hop in my car and drive to Los Angeles, which I did. Except for this extra padded hour of what the hell happened and who do I have to talk to and where are my friends that I was going to say goodbye to, but now they are filling out police reports in a side room while people are trying to find Vince Neil. It was sort of like the sixth most surreal thing that had ever happened for me at a show. I mean, that was pretty spectacular. But by the way, 2 weeks in Vegas, two police reports. I am two for two this time around. Just an amazing kind of circumstance. And P.S., with all this nonsense going on, I still have a show to do, and I have to get to Los Angeles to do the radio show from the studio today with the lovely and talented Tony Sorrentino, who is with us in studio today and is really second only to me in getting the least amount of sleep a human being can do. I think we're both being studied by the government. But so I thought I'd catch you guys up on that, because that is a growing story. There will be more details to be filled in on that as we go forward. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number, 1-800-STEPH-12. Program that into your phone. Give us a call. I do want to say our start off story. Let's give this this is pretty amazing. So Indiana official reportedly advised Scott Walker to stage a phony violent attack by union supporters. This is the second, I guess, Indiana prosecutor to suggest something similar or get in trouble for this kind of thing right away. But this is pretty amazing. It's all over Raw Story and Think Progress and all the sites this morning, but this is directly from Think Progress. During the intense public battle with public employee unions last month, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker received an intriguing email from an admirer claiming to be a deputy prosecutor from Indiana. The email suggested that Walker should fake an attack on himself in order to create sympathy for his cause and damage the reputation of unions. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism has the actual email, and this is a quote from the email itself. As an aside, I've been involved in GOP politics here in Indiana for 18 years, and I think that the situation in Wisconsin represents a good opportunity for what's called a false flag operation. If you could employ an associate who pretends to be sympathetic to union's cause to physically attack you, and then in parentheses, or even use a firearm against you, close parentheses, you could discredit the public unions. Currently, the media is painting the union protest as a democratic uprising and failing to mention the role of the DNC and umbrella union organizations in the protest. Employing a false flag operation would assist in undercutting any support that the media may be creating in favor of the unions. The email was signed Carlos F. Lamb. So the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism did some digging, discovered that indeed there is a Carlos F. Lamb, who is a GOP public official in Indiana. He's a deputy prosecutor in Johnson County, Indiana. And when he was confronted with it, all he said repeatedly was, "Geez, that's not me. I'm flabbergasted and would never advocate for something like this and would like everyone to be sure that it's just not me." He said after being read the email, he had plans to file a police report out about the matter this week. Jeez, he kept saying. Update. According to the Johnson County Prosecutor's Office, Lamb has admitted that he wrote the email and resigned his post. Right. So, and this is the furthest I've seen. I mean, we've heard about Fox and some of the people over there suggesting that they, you know, I mean, flat out falsifying what actually happened at events to make the protesters look more violent. This is the first time where someone has suggested to Scott Walker that he let someone shoot him, Bob Roberts style, so that he can get sympathy and people will know how violent the unions are. The unions aren't violent. You are. If you're completely comfortable with that kind of a solution to the problem, then that's what's occurring to you, then that's your go-to emotion. That's your go-to solution. You, indeed, sir, are violent. And you are trying to project that violence onto other people because they simply disagree with you. This is part of the whole meme that the right wing pushes. You know, the other side is violent. And to prove how violent they are, let's blow something up of ours and fake an attack to show you how much they want to attack us. Oh, and We'll show you how much of an agenda gay people have by setting an agenda on them. Hello? 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. We will be taking your calls and talking about an immense number of hypocritical moments that they've had in just the last 24 hours. Kind of stunning. And John Fugelsang will be joining us in the third hour today, and a couple other special guests as we go forward. I will be here. This is our last day of filling in. I'm very excited about it. Dial that 1-800-STEP-12 in your number. And by the way, you can join us in the chat at howlsparks.com/Ustream or just howlsparks.com. Watch the show. Get to see what Tony's mug really looks like, which is gorgeous. There he is running the board. He's extra unshaven today. We'll be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Join the party. 1-800-STEP-12.
Where it began, I can't begin to
I can't believe the show.
But then I know
I was going strong. Thank you very much. I gotta tell you. Wasn't the spring. More I gotta tell you.
Yes, that's Elvis singing Sweet Turpentine. No, Sweet Clementine, as Chris Bono would say. Sweet Carmine. Sweet Caroline. And sometimes I start joking down a window. I can't come back. I just go so far down the hallway of joking that I'm like, where was I? Anyways, so welcome back to the show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks. Our final day filling in before they return. We will have Fridays with Fugelsang later on in the show, third hour. Very exciting. While you're at it and waiting in great patience to talk to John Fugelsang or listen to what he has to say, follow John Fugelsang on the Twitter. That's a great way to start your political weekend. Let's go to we've got a bunch of callers coming in already. Let's go to Mary in Madison, Wisconsin. We were talking about Scott Walker getting this email from an Indiana prosecutor telling him to use a false flag operation to discredit the unions. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi, Hal. Yeah, I was really disturbed when I read that because I've been at these protests and sitting in the Capitol, and my husband has had to spend the night in the Capitol twice as a union leader. And if you see the people that are involved here, there are people bringing their kids.
Right.
There are people in wheelchairs because Badger Care is going to be cut. There are, you know, if you saw that email, or not the email, but the picture on Huffington Post of a 91-year-old woman in a wheelchair with her, you know, son pushing her because she's, you know, mm-hmm. upset about the cuts to seniors and everything. This is a crowd that feels empowered enough that just being there and being part of this movement is, you know, we're seeing that it's effective.
And they're sympathetic to it. That's the interesting thing. This guy didn't, wasn't tossing seeds on sand where Walker is concerned. This is something that they're, you know, they're open to this kind of behavior. I doubt Walker would read that and went, oh yeah, I'll let somebody shoot me. That makes total sense. But the idea that they're for plants or for discrediting the unions through, you know, fake, front situations that they create themselves is not shocking at all.
Well, and again, it shows that these are people from the outside
yes.
that are coming up with these ideas, because if people that were here participating would see how absurd something like that would be coming from the group that's actually protesting.
Right.
And people are there on their lunch hours. People are there, you know, coming after work and then running back and forth. And, I mean, this is not
this is as grassroots as anything ever need get. And these guys are aligning with the Koch brothers in that crowd and trying to create something of a fake opposition because they can't stand. It's like the Fox News reporters who are standing outside going, they hate the media. They're chanting against the media. Like, media? They're saying Fox News. That's not media in the abstract. This is very specific. They hate you guys, and they're saying Fox News lies.
And then they're accusing us of being thugs and everything, sure. Which is so far, again, if you look at the crowd, it's just there's nothing farther from
right.
the truth.
But absolutely.
I have another interesting point, but
sure.
it's about how, you know, the bill is being held up right now in the court.
Right.
And there is an interesting point made of why, with the Democratic senators back in town, why the Republicans haven't tried to just do a do-over and try to ram it through again,
mm-hmm.
With the senators now back in town. And there's kind of a scuttle going around that they don't think they've got the votes now with the Republicans that they could
right.
do it again.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they're looking at the writing on the wall. They know that this is not a popular thing to do, and it doesn't make sense. And even people who aren't directly involved in it, the people who aren't just directly the protesters themselves or the people who are involved in the union fight itself, the greater there's becoming a huge coalition of voters who are going, wait a minute, this is just wrong. Even though I'm not in this exact situation, even though I may be immune to it on a personal level, I'm not on a social level, and I'm not as a citizen, and I'm for these protesters, and the Republicans are seeing that they're going to have a hard time next time. I mean, this is akin in many ways to what's going on. And I thank you for the call, Mary. And by the way, and Mary makes a really good point in what was written across the thing, is that we need to oppose these policies peacefully and clearly. That has to be the meme we operate from. But this is, you know, yesterday came out, according to the census, that the Hispanic population in the United States has grown immensely, and is somewhere like 16% of the populace now, and is expected to, you know, to double in the next 30 years, I think, or something along those lines. A huge amount of people. And the Republicans, they're, you know, it's amazing, like, they are blind to this, or they think they can think them away, or just their own xenophobic fear of anybody who speaks Spanish or looks Hispanic at all will somehow make them evaporate one day. And they are so disconnected from the reality of these are not only just Hispanic people living in the country. These are Americans with all the voting rights and privileges therein. Just because you don't think they look like you doesn't mean you can somehow find a way to exclude them. But the Republican Party is doubled down on this. And they're going to use social conservative issues, assuming that Hispanics will value those elements of their, you know, their platform more than how awfully they've been treated. But I think like the Hispanic caucuses and the voters groups are recognizing that even if they come from a socially conservative viewpoint about gays or any other element like that, they recognize that once the Republicans are done coming down on those folks, they're going to come for them. And in some cases, they did it first. The immigration policy of the Republican Party cannot be more xenophobic and hateful towards Hispanics. And they do it unflinchingly. And then they go into a panic that there's this many Hispanic voters in the country. And their response to it is not, oh wow, I've been speaking against my own constituency. These are real Americans, and they deserve respect. You know, not the outsiders I thought they were. Now, instead of doing that, what they're doing is passing ID laws, hoping that Hispanic people will be too scared to get a state ID to go along with their driver's license in case it's taken away, so they can be denied access to voting at some point. Understand this is not an accident, but also understand that Hispanic voters aren't stupid. They're not, I don't know if they're shocked at this point, but they got to know that the entire breadth of the Republican Party is against them, clearly, cleanly, fully against anyone of a Hispanic background. And there may be the outliers that aren't, but the vast majority, and especially the Tea Party caucus of this, the anti-immigration fervor that comes from that side is immense. And because they just, I wouldn't say, I go so far as to say they dehumanize them, but they certainly don't see them as American in any way, no matter how long they've been here, no matter how ingrained in the society they are. Even, they, you know, some of them may have, their family line may have been here longer than the actual people in the Republican Party's family had been here. Regardless, here we'll be back after this. We got plenty of calls on this, especially from Wisconsin, dealing with this false flag story that came out. We'll be back right after this. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12, taking your calls. We'll be back right after this. that's not the original.
I'm the fear addicted, Danger Illustrated.
This is Gene Simmons' version of Firestarter. Pretty cool. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph. As you can tell, anytime I fill in, the music coming in and out of breaks really changes. And I thank you guys for putting up with that aspect of the show. It's really a great time. And it's all about Tony and I reclaiming rock from the right wing, you know, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Becks of the world, who play this kind of stuff in and out of their bumper music, but would never listen to it in their own life ever. Maybe Glenn Beck would in his gun fantasies, that if you go to his, you know, his site, you ever see those pictures of him where he looks like he's in 24 and he's actually carrying a gun, like he's on a mission? Horrible. The day of the Gifford shooting, that was one of the things, was one of those pictures came up. It's a randomized background, and there's a picture of him holding a gun. For no particular reason, other than to be macho, but I think like he might listen to something like that while he's playing with his gun in his giant, you know, cement iron, you know, rec room, you know, tornado shelter, Armageddon, you know, chapel. But we got a lot going on in Wisconsin, and I really do want to talk about, you know, the reality versus the media message on this, and you know. Luckily, MSNBC's been really, you know, gotten a lot better at, you know, keeping up the pressure and keeping the cameras on the protesters in Wisconsin. But Wisconsin, you know, Fox has been out against these guys for the whole time. Let's go to Tina in Madison. Hi, Tina.
Hi, you there.
Hiya.
I wanted to connect some dots from what you were talking about before.
Sure.
With the Indiana guy.
Right.
And the phone call from the fake, and the phone call from the fake Cook brothers. You know, you had Walker saying that they wanted to plant the troublemaker, and you got to wonder.
Right.
I'd love to see the dates between that email from the Lamb guy and the date of the phone call.
Yeah, not only is he violent, extremist, and psychotic, he's not original. You know?
Yeah, that's a way to put it too, and. You know, the whole Cook brothers thing.
Mm-hmm.
I work for the state, and it's really interesting. Our paper used to come from International Paper,
uh-huh.
and now it comes from Georgia Pacific, and which is owned by the Cook brothers.
Curious that, because you know, it was one of the hidden provisions in the bill that Walker was trying to push through with the help of the Republicans in the state legislature. There was that he could sell off any of the state's utilities for without any bidding whatsoever. No bid contracts for as little money as he wanted. A dollar, it didn't matter. He could privatize it and didn't matter who, and you never got a chance to say it. And I don't get how that's A, fiscally conservative, and B, open, and C, you know, smaller government. It seems just like a corporate yard sale.
Yeah, and another problem with that budget is that it makes the top lawyer of the agencies, the communication officer, and the legislative liaison, all appointed positions.
Right.
And it just so happens that one of the agencies has an LTE now, who for the construction of the communication liaison,
uh-huh.
who's the mistress of one of the Republican senators.
Huh. Go figure that. Is it the one that's actually living with the he's living with her in Madison?
Yeah, that makes she makes $10,000 more than the person that had the job before, and she didn't have to apply to the job. And
maybe that's why his wife wants to sign the recall petition. That they the protester showed up at this guy's house. I forget his name. I'll have to look it up.
Hopper.
That's right. The bed hopper. Randy Hopper.
Randy Hopper.
Huh? Yeah.
Randy Hopper. Yep.
Randy Hopper is this guy who's cheating on his wife with a mistress who's 25 years old, who's a lobbyist, who is making $10,000 more in her job than her predecessor. They show up at the wife's house. They show up at his house, and the wife answers the door and says he doesn't live here right now. He's living with his mistress in Madison, and they were there to present him with his recall petition and go, we're going to call you out, Randy Hopper. And it turns out not only was the wife willing to sign the petition, but the maid already had.
If the budget had gone through, that LTE position would have been an appointed position. So
right.
I think the only reason she's an LTE is
they were planning on. Yeah, they were jockeying for that position for her. Absolutely.
Yep.
Excellent point, Tina. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Janet in Madison as well. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Hal. I just wanted to tell you that the boycotts in Madison are working. And the way I know this is that we get Scrip cards through our school, which are gift cards that you can buy through a company. And then the company, like the company that I'm talking about would be Quick Trip, which is a gas station here. And so they normally donate 4% through those gift card buys to our school. Well, they, in the last week or so, more than doubled to 9% their donation through December.
Huh.
Which is, you know, that's they've never done that before. They've not even done it for a temporary small period, like, just for a month. So now they're doing it through December. So I think they're really realizing that they're getting boycotted, and because the Scrip cards are not being bought. So I just want to ask your opinion. What do you think of charter schools?
I'm not a fan overall. I think there is something to be said for alternative, teaching situations and more flexible teaching situations than sometimes, the giant, movement of a state school system or a federal school system will allow for right away. And sometimes, outsider and private schools can be a little bit more flexible, but they can also be a bigger failure, and you can't, tell out 10, 15 years, whether or not it's going to work or not. So the problem with it is it often just becomes a shell game of hiding money, and it doesn't actually go anywhere. So I'm not for it overall. They rolled into New Orleans and switched them all to charter schools, and the jury is still out whether or not they've basically, wrecked the system there. So, I'm not a fan, just for the record. And there's a lot of reasons, mainly because you're handing it over to private industries who have no, they don't actually get a profit based on output. They get a profit based on whoever's in office. So if the Republican just wants to say, I think they're doing a great job because there's fewer, more black kids are not showing up at school. Like, that's a plus for me, so I'm okay with that. That's not a cool thing at all. The standard is outside the federal system, and I think we do need a standard, and I think it should be higher. Anyways, thanks for the call, Janet. I appreciate it. Yeah. And, let's go to, we have a minute or two. Let's go to, Marie in Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Marie.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Hiya.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks.
To talk to you.
It's nice to talk to you as well.
I want to tell you, I want to let you know that I really admire what you're doing, that we need a spokesperson on the working person's and the poor person's behalf, because we know that these self-elected elitists want to definitely put us back on a level playing field with the third world.
Countries. Yeah.
If they had their way, we would get paid $1 a day, and all the social services that we have now would be a thing of the past, and it would be feudal and serf and king kind of
which is music to their
world.
Ears. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, Marie. It's you make an excellent point, and in many ways, oftentimes I hear Tom Hartman, for example, who I have great respect for, talk about how governments don't have to turn a profit, that industries have to turn a profit, and it always comes at the expense of anybody who's not in the upper 2% of a company. And that is absolutely the truth. They don't have to, that kind of profit doesn't have to come from the government. It doesn't have to show. It doesn't have to be, in the black all the time. I disagree in that there are two types. There are two types of profit you can show. One is cash. The other is benefit, outlay, quality of life. And in a government's profit is shown in the happiness and the healthiness and the quality of life of the citizens of the country. That's where the profit is shown. When a country is in the black, people are well-educated, well-fed, their water is clean, their roads are well-paved, they can get where they need to go. If their house is, catches fire by accident or arson, it can be taken care of. If they are attacked in any kind of outside way, there are police and FBI to make up for that, to protect them and or find the person who did it. That's the profit of a government, not cash. And there's we get so focused on the cash element of what profit is that that's how corporations get away with dumping toxic waste into the big agribusiness. If you look at the big pig farms, they have a tremendous amount of profit. But the only reason they have a tremendous amount of profit is because they'll produce as much waste as New York City, but they don't have to pay to get it treated. They don't have to clean up their messes. So they could take the cash off the top if they had to clean up the mess and better the life of the people around that space or protect the waterways. They would take less of a cash profit, and therefore, their business would be seen as less profitable. Whereas if you look at its effect on the life of people around them, even though the food that they put out would cost a little bit more, the benefit to everybody across the board in terms of clean, healthy food, clean, healthy water would actually be a bigger profit for everyone. They only view, private industry only views profit as the cash you take out after expenses are paid. That's it. That's the only expression of profit in private industry. But in government, the profit that comes from it is happy, healthy, free, safe citizenry, not cash. And it's harder to manage. It's harder to say outwardly because not everybody's ever going to be happy. We got to take a break. But I mean, this is a philosophical point I'm making, but I think unequivocally, we need to start making that clarification, don't we? 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. Aren't there more ways of garnering profit in a circumstance than just greenbacks, just cash or gold, as Glenn Beck will breathlessly say? Let me know. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show.
Oh, my God, that's kind of hot.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
The Stephanie Miller Show. I am Hal Sparks, blowing your eardrums out for one last day as I fill in for Steph. Here it comes. Oh, that just feels so good. And people think that's angry. Remember the guy called in and he was like, "That's angry music." I don't feel angry when I listen to that. That's a good proper distortion on a guitar is like a warm hug. It shouldn't be abrasive. It should be forceful, but inviting. You know what I mean? There's nothing hateful about any of this stuff. The ironic part is that dude man from Indiana who suggests false flag operations, for all we know, listens to Hall & Oates. I'm going out on a limb. He's not a helmet fan or a Tool fan. So certainly not a Tool fan, considering the politics that are going on in that band. Let's go to... Michael in New Orleans. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Great. And I'm sorry, I apologize for referring to you as Mike, because some Michaels are very picky about being referred to as Michael. So, sorry, Michael.
I really appreciate that. My name is Michael. It's
there
not
you go.
Mike.
Right, okay. There you go, Michael.
First of all, one comment that I'm sure we'll agree on. I think Glenn Beck's an idiot, okay? So I want to preface everything I say by that common ground.
Okay.
As an ex-Republican and current Libertarian, I'd like to make just three comments and to what I've heard you say over the last few minutes. I'm normally an NFL Network listener, but with the current labor agreement, I can't handle it.
Sure.
So,
right.
I'm
well,
kind of surfing left and right, and
Right. Well, I'm a big fan of taking showers, but I don't want to hear a plumber talk about how the piping works, and that's pretty much what's going on in the NFL right now.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Let me just tell you, as a longtime dweller here of the greater New Orleans area, just from a public person's perception. The charter schools are an increased success upon what was here before. So I understand your dislike of them philosophically. Philosophically, mm-hmm. I don't really like them either. But it's an immense success over what we had.
Well, it's hard to say in an increasingly red state down there, and in an area where, I mean, New Orleans being a very specific, it, almost like its own environment in the area.
It
doesn't really fit in. But on a state level, the attitude towards school systems is very right, very red, and the idea that it's public education shouldn't exist in the first place. So the undermining of the quality of it for decades is something that's hard to tell. But yeah.
Isn't that unfortunate? I mean, and it kind of it ties into the other points with, you know, the first thing I heard you say when I turned on was the generalization about the xenophobic Republicans. And I think, you know, there's a certain amount of that there's truth to it. I don't understand you. I don't know you. I don't look like you. So therefore, there's a dislike of you.
Right.
Unfortunately, that is, in my opinion, that's on both sides, be it progressive.
Well, I will disagree with you in one very specific point, which is the Republicans are in the process of legislating that activity right now. I may have a problem with you philosophically as a libertarian or that, but I would never seek to put in place a piece of legislation to keep you from exercising your rights as a libertarian to do that. Whereas the Republicans are literally working to put in place bills to limit women's choice, bills to limit gay people's choices in life, and the rights of minorities in this country, specifically towards immigrants. There is they're legislating, they're putting mechanical rubber to the road on their xenophobia, and they
believe that a lot of this is a self-cleaning oven. I mean, we saw this in the early 90s with the Contract with America, which is when I hit the road as a Republican and couldn't find a home in the Democratic Party, simply because I'm a fiscal conservative. I am socially liberal, but I'm fiscally conservative. Most of my social
liberalism
comes from my faith.
Okay.
In the Catholic Church.
Understood. But I also I would say, as far as to your fiscal conservative ideal, every Republican who's been in office in the last 60 years has been responsible for a larger growth in the deficit than the Democrat.
Oh, no disagreement here. Disagreement here or there, man. I tell you what, until the current president, the worst president we ever had was George W. Bush. I mean, I think that we're going to go down the last 15, 20 years, with horrible.
Well, keep in mind, even the current president, one of the reasons why his deficit is so big is because he came right in and said these wars are going on the books instead of in emergency supplementals. Which is how Bush Jr. had been doing it for years. And so the bloat to a lot of his deficit spending was going, I'm not going to pretend this money isn't being spent. And so it goes on the books, and it looks like all of a sudden we're adding all this money to the books, when the reality is we've been paying that for eight years.
No, I agree. And I'm not vilifying him for that particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish that there could be more. I would say you and I probably do not agree 100% on everything that
I should hope not.
We sit down and discuss. But at the same time, we can have. I feel like we could have the discussion on an open and honest and not a I hate you, you hate
no
me
question.
Just because I'm a Republican, you're a Democrat.
Right.
I just don't see answers or solutions coming with this current, the gun-toting right versus the entitlement left. You know, we're never going to see a solution.
I think if you look at what actual legislation is being put out, I think there is a genuine attempt to reach across the divide from this president, more so than I think a lot of progressives are comfortable with. And I think a lot of Democrats in the House are understanding that if they want to get a bill passed, they're going to have to reach across. But I do honestly believe, and this is not just hyperbole, I'm not just picking a fight, that the Republicans are laying down a hard line based on some sort of abstract principle that doesn't actually play out well in the real world, and they're going to stick to it regardless much like the general in Dr. Strangelove, when they're saying, you could destroy the entire world. Well, to preserve the American way of life, that's something I'm willing to do. I thank you for the call, and I'm glad we could have a legitimate conversation on that. We've got just 1 minute coming back in. Let's go into Quentin real quick. You got 1 minute. Quentin in L.A. Hi, Quentin.
That's Quentin.
Yeah.
Hi, I thought on this, the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York, we should mention the 146 people that died in that fire because the owner decided to lock some of the stairwells
leading
to the exits because he was afraid of people stealing from them. And the fact that if we didn't have unions, we wouldn't, we would still have those unsafe working conditions in a lot of places. So
absolutely.
I just thought it something to be mentioned.
I appreciate that, Quentin. Absolutely. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be back at the top of the hour with Representative Bruce Braley, Representative of Iowa's 1st Congressional District, and more of your calls. 1-800-STEPH-12. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph while she's away on vacation. Thank you for joining us today. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. And on the line right now, we are lucky enough to be joined by Representative Bruce Braley, a member of the U.S. House of Representatives for Iowa's 1st District. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Hal. I'm just still trying to figure out how you walk on sunshine.
I'm sad to say, it's a figure of speech. I have tried it, and it's it doesn't play out well. And it's one thing, if you're going to do it, practice in private, because the first couple of tries are going to be really embarrassing.
Okay, that's sound advice.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you're on here to talk about the circumstance in Libya, and I'd like to just straight off the bat get your kind of take on what's going on there and where we are and where we need to be.
Well, as you know, this problem is a huge dilemma for many of us in Congress and a lot of people around the country who see all the conflicting things that this challenge presents us. But we have a lot of serious challenges facing us at home. We're managing two military conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And I have taken the position that if we're going to be involved in Libya, we need to know how much a third military conflict is going to cost us. We can't let Libya become another Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's why I've called upon President Obama to give us an accurate answer on this point. And I think that Americans are always willing to stand with people fighting for freedom and democracy around the world. But we also need to know how much money we are committing and what it's going to cost us. And I've consistently taken this position on all of these conflicts since I got to Congress.
Right. And in our, you know, and this is my curiosity, and this is certainly something that we work out as being part of the UN Security Council, and of course one of the, you know, the biggest military in the world by a factor of six.
Yeah.
And often the first called when there's a circumstance for military action needed, by the UN Security Council. Do we not already have outlaid in our defense budget an element of these kind of actions based on UN security circumstances where we are, you know, where these things come up, the establishment of a no-fly zone, much like the 13-year-long one I think we had in Iraq since the first Iraq war that we established and kept going, which is an equivalent to this situation, but over a decade long.
Yeah, but you have to remember that was part of an authorization of force under the War Powers Act that Congress specifically gave to President Bush that was supposed to be limited in scope and required significant accounting from the White House on a consistent basis to justify the extension of that authority from Congress.
Right.
And I think you'd have a very hard time justifying the application of that authorization to this conflict. I think that Gaddafi is a criminal and a terrorist, but it's a hard time drawing the lines between that original authorization of force that took place before I became a member of Congress and what's happening in Libya right now.
Well, I think, history shows that every single act of war since World War II has been outside of this, you know, the congressional approval, essentially, in one form or another. It was already on its way, already being done before congressional approval was being given.
Right.
And in almost every case. And in the case of the, you know, the Iraq no-fly zone that was established for that long, even though it was given as part of, you know, congressional clearance was given, oversight was established for it, it was never curtailed. And there was no limitation on funds, limitation on ability done outside of, I guess, UN force. You know, moving in conjunction with UN forces saying, okay, the British will pick up some of the slack in this at some point. But that was done through the UN. Insofar as the United States was concerned, we just kind of, once it was established, it was kind of on autopilot.
Well, and that's the problem. It was also, if you remember, if you go back and look at the terms of the agreement, it was based upon some false premises, and that was the
almost completely
the
false premises
of weapons of mass destruction,
right,
and the need to eradicate them. And so, you know, that's the problem with Congress ceding its control to the White House, no matter who is in the White House,
right,
is that there is an appropriate role for Congress under the Constitution. Members of Congress need to be involved, engaged in that decision-making process. There are certainly national security emergencies that can require the president to exercise his authority as commander-in-chief to mm-hmm. make commitments of certain types of action. But this thing has been unfolding for some time in Libya, and it's important for this White House and this president to realize that Congress is a partner in this process and that we need to be involved and informed. And we represent the American people, who are the ones who really have a stake in all of this because
That's
of
true.
The demands we're placing on
certainly,
them.
Certainly, certainly. And as a body and as an equal branch of government necessary to that process, the president arguably, you know, as a single representative representing a larger swath of people than a single congressional district would, and the question comes up in legitimacy, and I'm not being facetious about this, I really do mean this, is the House currently, because of the leadership and because of how committees are run there and because of who's in charge, a trustworthy body that you can say in due order will provide the necessary means to do something like this? Or would it have dragged out and more Libyans would have been killed in this process and we may have agreed to do it anyways?
You know, that's a real dilemma for progressives, Hal.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want an open-ended commitment like we saw in Iraq, and giving the president the discretion to make decisions without informing and consulting with Congress and getting the appropriations through the regular appropriations process, unlike putting it all on supplemental appropriations outside the budget
sure.
that add to our deficit.
Right.
And so the American people deserve to have us actively engaged. So whether and the sad reality from my point of view is the leadership we have is the leadership that the people of this country determined based on the election on November 2nd. And so I have to work within that structure, even though I'm very frustrated by what's happening. And so the thing that the American public needs to understand is they have to keep the pressure up on the current leadership and demand accountability and demand that Congress get answers
right.
Before we make another open-ended commitment without any clear direction or understanding
sure.
of what we're buying.
The president has stated unequivocally, and you can see it almost that it's the content of the meetings that he's been having, that he has no intention of this being an open-ended conflict. And I do think there is a fair conversation to be made that there is a difference between what's happening in Libya with a genuine coalition and French fighters in the air and a balance of, you know, there are no American boots on the ground in terms of ground troops. We did have a rescue, but the rebels that we were actually supporting protected those the pilot until they arrived. There is a difference of circumstance in this than the Iraq war. It is not all things being equal. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I do, and I just came back from Afghanistan, and one of the things that's amazing is how many international forces are on the ground there, are involved in training. But when I got my briefing in Belgium at NATO headquarters before we went there, and we got this briefing about the extent of international commitment, I explained to them what my week before had been like and the visits that I had made to wounded constituents who were paralyzed from the neck down or missing both legs or had penetrating closed head injuries. And I said to the commander, who is the current Dwight Eisenhower, can you name one of our coalition partners who can identify a member of their parliament or governing body who had a week like I just had?
Right.
And that stopped them right in their tracks because they can't.
I totally agree.
And we appreciate the role of our international partners, and they were doing a great job when I had contact with them. But this operation needs to be led by our NATO allies and the international community, including from the Arab League, because we have led this response for far too long, and the American people, I think it's very obvious, are getting fatigued from that responsibility.
I will agree, and I appreciate your point of view on this. I will say that I do feel like the president did something that is completely unprecedented, based on how the last president established the other two conflicts were involved in that he did go to the UN Security Council. He did establish a group of like nations as opposed to underling nations that don't have the force being able to equal, this situation. And we literally saw British, French, and American troops in the air on an equal footing, as opposed to this kind of illusion of, and I think it's important to make that distinction. And again, I think with progressives and yourself, that I think what we're all concerned about is it's the precedent, not the president. That we need to make sure that the next president that gets in there, George Bush style, if that happens, or if there's one day, God forbid, a President Palin, we don't end up with them having the ability to just race into any theater of war that they choose. And I think that's the bigger concern.
I think our basic goal has to be to stop Gaddafi from killing his own people,
right.
And I will always stand for people around the globe fighting for democracy. The problem, as you know, is there are many, many of those challenges around the globe, and it's how we pick and choose who we're going to intervene on behalf of that's often troubling to progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that's always the missing piece of this conversation is our dependence on foreign oil and in oil coming from this region that seems to dominate these conversations.
No question. Thank you so much for such a great conversation about this as well. Representative Bruce Braley, U.S. House of Representatives, Iowa's 1st District, thank you so much, sir, for joining us today.
Great to be on the program.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Take care. Reasonable disagreement and important distinctions made in an actual conversation about policy. This is really the sausage being made insofar as policy goes that we always think is not worth listening to, not worth hearing. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number, and I would love to hear your opinion on this part of it. And plus, when we get back, I've got a couple of stories that I think. Well, we'll talk about it when we get back. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show.
For a good time, call now. 1-800-STEP-12.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show, where Scary's on his way. That's no deference to who we have calling in right now, and we're lucky enough to talk to the comedic powerhouse, the intellect of intellects, Rick Overton. Rick, thank you for joining us. Oops, do we get him? There he is.
I love that intro. Can I use that again?
Absolutely. We will always intro you with Alice in Chains.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, how are you? Obviously you've been, keeping up on a lot of this stuff. And this is, do you feel like you've died and gone to 1982? Because here, rising gas prices, problems in Libya, this, it's like time folding onto itself.
Yeah, I think it's a time for more Iron Eagle movies.
Right, yeah. Lou Gossett Jr. maybe.
Rescue his dad because they keep his dad actually on the airbase in a little tin shack. That,
right.
You know, that you could just kick the door in and get him out and get him on board your plane and get out of there. You know, I think it's like Obama needs a winnable war. He needs one of those Grenada size. They got 9 jets. You take them out. The rest is like just sort of mowing
right.
the lawn, you know. And you got 2012 in the bag after that.
See, I think he's almost the exact opposite. That, you know, you have Bush who would come in and go, just give me another war. Maybe something looks good. You know, something I can wear a cod piece, land on a aircraft carrier. How about, do you have one of those old British cod pieces you can wear that's all pointy? Like the nose of the guy in V for Vendetta? But Obama, you can tell, like, just him being flabbergasted. Like, really? This is, all of his press conferences look like he's going, really? Really, do I have to do this crap more? Do we need to be involved more in this area of the world? Have I not given $100 million in loan guarantees for solar energy? Can we not use oil anymore? How many times do I have to tell you people?
Yeah, and in reality, he's the entire Obama presidency has been sort of a demonstration of what power that position actually holds in 2008 through now, you know?
Yeah. It's
very little power at all.
Yeah, well, especially when you've got a situation where Jim DeMint, for example, is saying that no bill will get through the Senate floor without going through his office. He'll put silent holds on everything. Well, at what point does the Congress and the Senate actually have any meaning as a governing body of multiple people? If a single senator can put an anonymous hold on a bill, what's the difference? Isn't that kingship of some sort? I don't get that. And they won't change the rules to shift it. That's crazy to me.
Well, a lot of kingship showing up these days.
Right.
A lot of royalty behavior there, whether it's in Washington or in Wisconsin or... Yeah.
Ohio.
And Michigan. They're starting to be, you know, turn people into serfs over there, you know?
Yeah. It's a, you know, and the interesting thing to me is yesterday we did a little clip from CNBC. And they were talking about the dollar. Steve Forbes was talking about the importance of a gold standard, and everybody else was talking about the fact that you do realize it's just a pretty rock, right? And that there are better things to base your value as a country on than just a pretty rock. But the what they had written as the byline for the entire segment was King Dollar, the King
yeah.
Dollar. And, you know, is King Dollar doing okay? Is King Dollar being taken down? And the idea that they would use in a democracy the word king as a positive and not a pejorative is indicative of how they think.
Yeah, you know, remember what color the coats were when they were coming?
Right. Red, indeed. Which states are we having trouble with?
They never switched coats. They just switched names for the coat.
Right. The red coats are coming. Right.
They're still the British.
I think I need to go put a lantern in one of the windows right now. They're definitely coming by land because these people don't want to be on boats. They might drift into a foreign country. These are the kind of folks who will never get on a cruise ship that goes anywhere outside the U.S. Virgin Islands because they might have to speak Spanish. I say to you, Rick Overton, how in the world do you have a conversation with someone who is, so far down the road? I was lucky enough to have a couple of libertarian callers today who were like, let's have a legitimate conversation. I'm okay with that. How do you talk to the ones who aren't, or do you bother?
Well, you know, this entire situation is everyone thinks almost all politics in the 21st century seem to be boiled down to a group of people who thinks the other group of people are getting all their info from the wrong radio station or the wrong TV show.
Right, right.
Almost entirely that's what it is.
Right.
Because no one gets their info from anything else. Oh, you're watching the wrong TV show or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I will take that approach because it's the one thing that kind of keeps the ball field level. I can say, well, then, okay. Then you're thinking that there's a TV show out there that can give me wrong info. So then how about a mile in my moccasins and say that maybe there's the remotest possibility, since we've now established and proven that someone can get the wrong info from a TV,
right,
that the same might be true for you. I always bring a big stuffed pocket full of cards to say all the ways I got tricked. Clinton tricked me.
Right.
NAFTA, you got me. And here's how I think an American and a man looks like. I admit when that happened to me.
Right.
And it's not fun, but I'm proud of the fact that I can say,
you're capable of it. Right.
Nope, you got me. And I think, you know, establish that there's a form of manhood where you can do that.
Absolutely. And that's why you're one of the manliest people I know, Rick Overton. Thanks so much for calling in, brother. And we will see you out on the road. Rick Overton, do you have a website?
RickOverton.net, but you probably catch me saying more up-to-date things on
Twitter,
Facebook, Twitter, and mostly the Facebook is where I get my,
gotcha,
my biggest opinions,
all right,
out there.
Cheers. We'll talk to you later. Peace
talk
out.
Later. Bye.
Rick Overton. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I am Hal Sparks. We just got to speak to Rick Overton. We talked to Representative Bruce Braley of the 1st Congressional District of Iowa this hour, and we will be talking to John Fugelsang next hour. Been a blast of a show. Turns out, kids, that I'm in the number one story on TMZ this morning in relation to what I told you this morning. Yeah, great. You know, and everybody knows what a big fan of TMZ I am. Cops called after Vince Neil goes ballistic in Vegas is the story. Battery report was filed against Vince Neil last night in Vegas after an alleged altercation with his ex-girlfriend, TMZ has learned. Sources tell TMZ Neil's ex was at a Hal Sparks concert at the Las Vegas Hilton when Neil allegedly stormed in and started screaming obscenities at her and her two friends. We're told security at the hotel called Las Vegas PD. According to our sources, a woman told police Neil got physical with her and one of her friends. The woman tells TMZ police took a battery report, but appears Neil was not arrested. He just served 10 days in jail for last month for a DUI charge. They have his picture from his last arrest on the actual site with TMZ across it, as if they were the ones who took the picture at the police station. That's amusing. So let's get to more of your calls, because this is, you know, in the discussions of war and peace and the discussions of how we are going to deal with these big issues. Again, a lot of progressives, when they have problems with what's going on in Libya, they're afraid of the precedent, not the president. They really do trust that Obama's making a decent decision here. They're just worried about that the precedent gives somebody, like, if the second coming of George Bush Jr. to come in there and do anything they want again and again. The problem is, and I discussed this yesterday, when are they going to change the law? They're going, well, we should just follow the law. Well, there's enough precedent since 1945, essentially, for any president to come in and between the flexibility of the War Powers Act and the flexibility of the UN Charter to pretty much start any fight he wants to anywhere in the world and commit forces without ever going to the Congress in the first place. He's got 60 days to do it and can do it as a full 90-day extension, and then he has to eventually go to them. But at that point, we're already committed for 3 months. So are you gonna really be able to make the case other than really anti-war progressives who really come out and go, why are we there, and try to, but they're gonna be, the tide will already be in place. So let's go to Arthur in Chicago. Hey, Arthur.
Good morning, Hal.
Morning.
Yeah, I just want to hold a conversation with you.
Okay.
Didn't Bush go to the Congress and get clarification for his war in Iraq? I call it a war in Iraq.
I would
and
call
he did. He went to the Congress. He went to the UN. He got as much unilateral help as he could get. Now, number one.
First of all, you know, it's not unilateral help. It's, you know,
well, whatever.
Right. Coalition help.
I'm
know what you're talking about.
I'm not a professional like the other person you had. I'm just an American citizen, a union worker,
okay,
who has brains, who at least thinks. I don't have the brain, but I think about things. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
And one of the ways that he convinced the Congress.
Well, I don't care how he did. He didn't lie, because Hillary Clinton, John Kerry said they're in our way because they got misleading or
sure
false from the thing. So, you know, there wasn't a perfect CIA what they, what the information he got. This I can understand. See, I was in the Army, okay?
Understood. Well, Army, you know, goes where they're told by the people that they are entrusted
they
to follow.
He's got his bombs. He's got whatever.
They were told by Curveball, and they were told by people who've been tortured by, the people.
Get off of that. Will you talk like a gentleman? Will you? Then you know that's a bunch of crap.
No, it isn't. It's actual fact.
Yes,
and if you look at what Curveball, they've literally come out that Curveball made up information on purpose.
Get off of there, will you please?
All right. Look, if you're just going to pick a fight about it when the facts point directly to it, the Bush administration falsified information that got us into the war in the first place. The Downing Street memo shows very clearly that in collusion with Blair, they created false premises to lead Congress into believing that and the rest of the world in some cases that the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction that they did not have. They knew they didn't have them. That's why we went in. The big concern why we haven't gone into Iran, for example, several times is because they do have the ability to fight back. The reason we went into Iraq is because we knew their pants were down, because we'd set it up that way for a decade. It's just absurd to kind of make, that I'm being ungentlemanly because I'm bringing up the details of what the Bush administration did to falsify our reasonings for going into Iraq in the first place. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We're not responsible for 9/11. We're not in collusion with 9/11. The people who were responsible for 9/11. So the idea that somehow he Bush did it right is kind of absurd. Let's go to Deirdre in Annapolis, Maryland. Hi.
How are you?
I'm great.
Listening to that last caller, Stephanie calls my husband the Great Santini. I'm married to a retired Marine colonel.
Uh-huh.
And we're not on the same team in every area almost. But in any case, there's no arguing with someone who thinks President Bush never did anything wrong.
Right.
But I mean, the latest thing is a couple of things I've noticed that the right-wing talk hosts are becoming so vitriolic and so obsessed with President Obama's use of force, because now they have no argument about, man up, tell the little boy to get some gumption.
Right.
I mean, if you could have heard Sean Hannity yesterday, it was so he's so angry. He could barely speak. He's so angry because he's trying to find something he hates Obama about, and he can't say he didn't go in and protect these people. Well, he's now doing it, and he's going, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's a no-win situation.
Right.
But more than that, I want to know where the good Republicans are. I want to know where, because I came from a Republican family.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know where the outrage is about how their party has been co-opted by Governor Walker and the folks from Indiana who are doing those false ops. I want to know where the Republicans are. Where are
right.
the good Republican women who are embarrassed about Michelle Bachman and Sarah Palin? Where are these people?
I agree.
Are they gone?
Well, I would say yes. I think they abdicated that party a long time ago. In many ways, I've said this before, but you can literally have an entire conversation from liberal to conservative on the Democratic Party, a legit conversation. I may disagree with the genuine conservatives, but you could call Ben Nelson one. You could call Ben Nelson a Reagan Republican for all practical purposes, even though he's technically a Democrat. Whereas what's left of the Republican Party are now just kind of sort of somewhere between, Kool-Aid drinkers and propagandists, and the Tea Party has been coming in to fill a vacuum in that party because it's largely based on nothing. It got pantsed in the 2008 election because people recognized it wasn't based on anything.
I'm from Connecticut. I'm telling you, there's got to be some country club people in Greenwich who are going, what?
Right.
Where are they?
Right. I understand, but I, you know, in all honesty, I think they become, they at one point rolled over and became conservative Democrats, and they call themselves, they'll say the word independent, they'll say the word libertarian, they'll say I'm socially liberal, but I'm fiscally conservative, like that caller earlier, who would, you know, arguably be technically a conservative Democrat at that point, because you can't be a Republican and actually be for gay rights or women's rights at this point, because there's not a single piece of legislation that is pro anybody, gay, female, or brown, that's ever going to come out of that party going forward. I mean, it's if you're in...
That's a mystery, why anybody of those colors, like, you know,
yes.
I said to her the other day, how do you explain Clarence Thomas to me? Just explain him to me.
Well,
how did this happen?
Well, I mean, I think they're, you know, almost any group can, you know, someone can be any member of any group. That's the thing about individuals in any party, any situation, can find a way to go against their own best interest. There were black soldiers who fought for the South in the Civil War. That isn't indicative of the greater group by any stretch. So,
yeah.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you for all you did this week. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. I had a great time as well. Let's see. Let's go to Jason in Asheville. Hey, Jason, how are you?
Doing well. How about yourself?
I'm great.
Hey, first off, I wanted to really thank you for the demeanor of the show this week. It's been a really nice having a serious show versus a lot of jokes, kind of.
Thanks. Well, I feel bad because I feel like I should be doing a few more jokes, but because of the circumstance we're in, it feels like sometimes it's necessary to have that, you know, a more serious conversation. So, yeah,
no,
but I thank you.
No, we all appreciate it because, you know, it's it keeps everybody more aware, and it's more appreciative for everybody. But I really wanted to touch on the economic aspect of Libya in particular. We're going into a situation where we don't know whether we can pay for it, and how do we pay for it? And I really just – I was hoping to get you to comment on other possible ways of paying for –
the Libyan conflict?
The situation.
Right.
And even whether or not we should pay for it.
Well, that's certainly a reasonable debate. I think the money that it, specifically, the way it should be working, whether it is or not, it's always, you know, the military budget is one of the biggest, you know, it's so hard to get a grip on because it is ginormous and so watery. You cannot, you know, you're not pinning down where the money goes would make your enemies able to pick out, okay, they're allocating this much funds for this and this much funds for this, so we can tell where that's being built so we can blow up this plant. That's why one of the positive reasons why they keep it such a mystery. I'm gonna let you go because there's a little bit of noise, and I'll try to if that's cool, I'll describe I'll try to clarify this. We have a certain amount of money set aside in the Defense Department budget for UN Security Council no fly zones and those kind of things, and they keep that there always as an availability. So that's one of the reasons why the president didn't need to go ask for more money. There's and by the way, there's no end of military machinery sitting around. When you have, you know, six times the amount of military of the rest of the world combined, you've got plenty of planes and, you know, and pilots and bombs and ordnance being built and dropped all the time. I mean, one of the biggest problems with nuclear weapons in this country is the fact that they're spoiling like eggs. We've had them since the 80s, and they're leaking, and because they're never used. And so part of the cost of our nuclear arsenal has been the maintenance of these, you know, these decaying, archaic weapons. And so the military factors into their budget a certain amount of spent ordnance, and so that always leaves any president the ability to, you know, pull a certain amount of ordnance, a certain amount of soldiers, a certain amount of flights, a certain amount, and without ever having to go for extra money because it's sort of prepaid for. We have a standing army. Now, the valid, you know, whether or not we deserve a valid, whether we should have a standing army is a conversation, you know, that, you know, Jefferson was never for it. There's a lot of, you know, it's as much as people want to kill the welfare programs and say it was never in the Constitution, nor was a standing army, and we have had one for a very long time. And that standing army can be called upon at any point. It is always paid for. The money for it, insofar as you're concerned about where the money's come from, always borrowed. currently right now because of the deficit we're running. As much as there's a panic about the deficit when you're running, when we ran into a recession the size that we've had, you can run a deficit that's 150-180% of your GDP, and it's not that, it's ultimately not as big a deal. It is the, essentially, if you look at anybody who owns a home, they are more than likely running a technical deficit. If you look at what they pay for their house and what their house is worth and how long they're going to have to take to pay it off, you know, their house is whatever 900% of all the money they could make in the next 10 years because they're spreading it over 30 years. So you got a 35-year mortgage. If you looked at it like the military budget or you looked at it like our deficit, it starts to make sense because, you know, if you extrapolate, the problem is you can't run it that long for that long. That's why, Clinton was so big on balancing the budget and starting to bring it down, and we got to a surplus fairly quickly considering where we were at the time in absolute dollars. So, the money being borrowed is being established in bonds. The bonds are bought by foreign investors, American investors, and that kind of thing. When we say Chinese money, it's not because we go over there and go, hey, can we have some more money? We need some renminbi, which is the Chinese dollar. That's not how it works. We sell bonds. They buy them on the open market. The Chinese own a lot more of them than a lot of people these days. And we do go to them and go, hey, you want to buy some bonds? We're establishing some more of them. But it's not quite as like going to get buckets of cash and then spending it in an exchange. That's how Bush paid for stuff in Iraq. They showed up with American dollars in wheelbarrows and let it disappear. It's a little difference there or whatever. We got to take a break. We have a bunch of calls on this. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. In the next hour, we'll have John Fugelsang. But after this break, we'll take more of your calls. There's some great points being made in there. We'll get to Victor and Judy and Kevin and Eileen and Will and Charles and Melissa. You're all. I see you there, and we will try to get to you. We'll be back. It's Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
There's a tea party in her pants, and you're invited. Call now, 1-800-STEF-12.
Are you playing that, Tony, strictly because I have whereas I may not have a good relationship with Vince Neil these days, I have a terrific relationship with Sebastian Bach, who I sang with on Celebrity Duets, and I find to be a sound dude who's a lot of fun to be around. Even though he does look like Alan Alda with long hair these days, as he gets older a little bit, he kind of has an Alan Alda kind of look to his face, which, by the way, generations of women loved. During MASH and whatnot. He was a sex symbol in the 70s. But he does have kind of a big baby voice because he protects his throat by speaking in his highest register. So whenever you meet Sebastian Bach, he is like 9 feet tall and has a voice kind of like this, dude. It's kind of amazing. So let's get to some of these calls because there's so much to talk about. Let's see. Eileen in Cadenbridge? West Virginia?
Capen, as in, it's Capen, C-A-P-O-N.
Okay. Okay, Cadenbridge. Okay, excellent. Well, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
And you're doing a great job. I find it laughable that we are getting involved in Libya under the aegis of the oppression of the people when you look at, you know, Zimbabwe or Darfur, the Palestinians, not only the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, but the Palestinians in Jordan, mm-hmm. who went there in the 60s and the 67, and for centuries they've been there. Decades.
Yeah.
And these people live in squalor. There's curfew. They're not allowed to become citizens. It's horrible. And here we are getting involved in Libya because of our so-called concern for the oppression of the people there, when it's obvious that it's laughable that it's due to our interest in oil. It's upsetting to me.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I agree. I think there's a lot of progressive guilt about why Darfur was not handled, and I think Clinton has expressed regret that was one of the biggest regret of his presidency. And I think because we didn't go in Darfur when we should have, does not mean we don't go into Libya when we can. I think those are two different things. I just think it's, and I think it's important that we do play a role in those situations. And there's almost it's hard to pin down the argument for progressives on that, because there is that leftover anger about why we didn't do something in Darfur, because I think there's a lot, I mean, it was such a horrible situation and an obvious situation where we could have helped.
And what about Zimbabwe, though? I mean, it just seems like it's because of the color of the skin. It's because of, you know, our interest is not there due to oil.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, all this changes when we get off oil. Can you?
Right.
I mean, the entire structure, not only of our relationship to that region of the world, but those leaders in those countries, their relationship to their own people changes when they're not a resource based economy that everybody has to clamor and kowtow to.
Right.
There's no such thing as a hardline dictator on a country that is known for really exporting fruit, let's say, that you can grow elsewhere.
Like South America.
Exactly. And I think that's, that will be the growth over time. And it's sad that that's where we're stuck to. And that's where we have to move on. That's where our, but I think we have to take that responsibility for where were we during this. And I think we need to, pushing to support what's going on in Libya in a proper way, going, look, these people were going to get straight bombed and slaughtered. Gaddafi said he was going to go door to door murdering anybody in the rebellion. Mm-hmm. And we had an opportunity to go, we can't let that happen. We cannot let that happen. And I don't think by doing that we abdicate our guilt about not acting in Darfur, but I think it establishes an American value. Where are we going to use our military might, and will we use it in a valuable way, as opposed to just Iraq, where we take what we want.
The Palestinians and Jordan, I mean.
Absolutely. Look at, and I appreciate the call. We're up against the break.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Barack Obama is getting a lot of flack for his relationship with Israel and is trying to be balanced with the Palestinians there. Where are we on that? We got John Fugelsang coming up in the next hour, and there will be a great conversation there, no doubt. We got some great callers on the line, too. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in the waning hours of The Stephanie Miller Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they are away on vacation. We are in our final hour of my week here, and it has been a tornado of information and activity and conversation. I'm particularly proud of how, in spite of the fact that these are very contentious issues we are discussing, even across great divides, we have managed to have a fairly decent conversation about it. And you fail at it sometimes, and you succeed at it sometimes, and it's completely okay, because there's a lot of emotion involved in it, and it's important that you feel. Our empathetic reflex is actually built on how attached we are to outcome, and that's a good thing. And speaking of someone who's attached to outcome, on the line with us is John Fugelsang, genius, bon vivant, intellect, comedian. I've done shows with you. I can attest how funny you are, and well-meaning and smart. And it is good to have you on the show. Thank you, sir.
It is good to be back. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm
you and I have
Northern. Go ahead.
We haven't talked in ages.
It's been a long time. Yeah, I know. I've been on the road, and you've been on the road, and right now I'm up in Northern California selling potassium iodide smoothies.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. You know you're not supposed to take that yet. You know that's just a panic attack waiting to happen. Although I would...
Wow, don't tell the California people that.
But I think you just sell them to the Iowa crowd because I think they'd be more panicked. You know what I mean? I think the Californians are keeping up on the information. They tend to be a bunch of readers. But you might be able to go to Montana and...
Not the Real Housewives, Al, please.
Excellent.
I opened up a waterboarding clinic last year because I told the housewives it was good for the pores. Now, potassium iodide smoothie stand, doing gangbusters.
Right, good. Okay, well, then I'm not going to mess with a good thing, then.
Thank you.
This is, well, let's start right there. The upside, if there is one, of the crisis in Japan is that people are rethinking this kind of laissez-faire attitude towards nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, for all the great arguments about how green nuclear power is, the problem is, what are you going to do with the waste? And we still don't know in this country, and it gets swept under the rug, so to speak. You know, there's a lot of positives, not to sound weird, but to this whole Japanese tragedy and seeing the dignity and grace and strength of the Japanese people,
yeah.
While the American media is hysterical over the lack of Japanese hysteria. We've had GeigerCounters.com has sold so many detection units, they've begged people to stop placing orders. We have people saying that this is a reason for more nukes. I'm expecting Lou Dobbs to call for an 80-foot-high tsunami wall directly across the U.S.-Mexican border. You know, it's people are all about what does Japan mean to me here in America? I might get trace elements of radiation somehow.
Right.
And, you know, you'd think that people would be comforted having a president who can pronounce the word nuclear and saying that it's not going to be a problem. But we had the cover of Daily News last week, which was just a person in a gas mask and a giant headline, panic. So,
well, you know, and also I would like to go on record and say that nuclear energy is a green energy, but only in relation to the glow that it gives you when it fails. It's not quite the same thing that we're mm-hmm. shooting for with solar and wind, which in terms of, you know, of energy outlay could solve all of our problems consistently in the country, even at standard technology. And we all know that technology grows every 18 months. So
yeah.
If we just, you know, we forget there was a time when these old energy sources weren't as effective as we like to think they are now. And they took a lot of, you know, hit and miss and a lot of experimentation to get to the moderately level, you know, useful level that they're at now. You know, we have never found a way, you know, well, I mean, we found it, but, you know, cars to get more than, you know, 35 miles to the gallon consistently without, you know, battery support. That's probably there, but the big car companies didn't want it to get through. But it's not an impressive level of technology, yet we've grown comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to produce, we have to deal with all the waste from a nuclear facility, which, by the way, is a big tea kettle. With instead of a electric burner under it, it's just a pile of electron, nuclear matter that when you put it close to each other starts to heat up uncontrollably and will do so for decades.
Yes.
It's a steam turbine. It's not, they didn't think of, people think it's like something in Iron Man where they can, you know, they can hook up and some magical energy comes forth out of it like it's out of Gandalf's hands. It's a steam turbine run by nuclear waste, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's not impressive. So where do we go? How do we get this message across to people?
Well, you have two things we can do. Number one, you can pass a law that says that all CEOs of nuclear power plants have to live within 20 miles of whatever they do with the waste. And then we'll know how safe it is.
Right.
Number two, you know, last month was Texas Independence Day when a bunch of men were calling for Texas to secede from the Union when
sure.
they should really just secede from high fructose corn syrup.
Uh-huh.
I say that all these jerk-offs who want to express their anti-American sentiment and talk about secession should be allowed to secede. And when they come crawling back in 6 months because tobacco and NASA aren't enough to sustain their economies, we make them put up the grids. And that's how it works.
Right.
When you secede, when you come crawling back to the Union at Appomattox this time, you have to put the solar power grid in your state.
Right, which won't happen, by the way. And ultimately, they'll just get consumed by the Mexican drug cartels because we'll have taken away our federal police, our Air Force bases, our military bases, our the energy grid itself will be shut off, and they'll have to create all their own energy. And considering that they put out more, they take in more tax money from the country than they put out, I don't know how that's not a swirly that they're going to. Yeah.
The good news is that Ann Coulter went on Bill O'Reilly to say that some radiation is good for you and
sure.
that we shouldn't be worried about it. She said a growing body of evidence in the radiation excess of what the government recommends is good for you and can reduce cancer. I know it can reduce the appearance of an Adam's apple.
Sure.
She's proof, but I don't really think that that's the case.
No, you have to understand, any creature that crawls from sludge would describe nuclear material as a positive.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we all love our mommy. And if you're the result of, you know, being bitten by some sort of radioactive cockroach, you know, some normal teenager bit by some sort of monster, and then you now I have multiple genitals and I'm able to blend in every crowd. I'm a chameleon of thought. then you're going to like nuclear waste. So, and by the way, are you enjoying the back and forth flip flopping of the right in the lead up to the 2012 about both nuclear and the Libyan conflict?
Well, the Libyan conflict, I got to tell you, is the most fun for me.
Yeah.
I do think it's fun. I'm viewing all this as being there for my entertainment. You got Newt Gingrich coming out on a Thursday, last Thursday, and said that the president's caution on Libya makes us look weak and uncertain,
right.
And then on Sunday releases statements calling the mission opportunistic and reckless. So Obama's timid and he's reckless is what we've heard, which means that Newt Gingrich can't even be faithful to one of his own memes. The guy's
right.
committing adultery on his own talking points.
Right, yeah. His own thoughts are sleeping around. yeah, here's the quote from him. If he's serious about protecting civilians, you can't do that from the air. Gaddafi is going to use light infantry. He's going to use his secret police. He's going to be in cities. He's going to be inside buildings. You're not going to be able to do that with air power. This is a fundamental mistake, and I think it's a typical politician's over-reliance on air power. Wow.
Yeah.
So his problem is, Gingrich's essential argument is, we need to start another Iraq. We need to drop soldiers into this situation instead of just supporting a legit uprising that's going on there from the air, like the mandate from the UN, which is very limited, allows us to do. He wants us to commit feet to the ground. It's not enough that we still have soldiers in Iraq, even though technically our military action has ended there, and that we've got more people in Afghanistan than should be there by any stretch of the imagination. That's not enough. He wants soldiers on the ground in Libya, and if you try to use pilots, that's an embarrassment, because what are pilots good for?
Exactly. Although I would take issue with one thing. When people say that we're done with military action in Iraq, believing that is sort of like making love to Heidi Montag. It may feel good, but it's not actually real. I don't think that, you know, we're actually done in Iraq by any stretch of the imagination. We're now at war in three different countries for the first time since World War II, all three of them Muslim, and that's not counting Pakistan,
mm-hmm.
Where we just send drones in. But I thought the best part of the whole saga was when the UN, after 40 years of terror and human rights violations and lavish corruption amidst the poverty of his own people and mass slaughter against protesters of the regime, when the UN in 2011 was finally able to agree in principle that Muammar Gaddafi is, in fact, kind of a douche,
mm-hmm.
That was real progress. We waited a long time for
right.
that. Because a lot of people want to forget that, you know, Bush was the one who made this guy our ally.
Right.
And immediately after the resolution that authorized force, Gaddafi promised he'd withdraw the troops with a ceasefire, and then he kept the attacks up, which proves that he's just another guy who lies when he promises to pull out while wearing eyeliner.
Right.
But, you know, people want to forget that this guy, when Reagan bombed him, I don't know if Reagan had to get all this jumping through hoops for congressional approval to bomb him back then. But
and there were certainly not the same people, by the way, that were in office at that time in senatorial and congressional positions. We're certainly not clamoring for, Reagan to ask their permission. He had mm-hmm. it tacitly because they loved him so much.
Exactly.
And he was not other.
And people already hated him, Gaddafi, back in the 80s, because he was the only guy in the 80s to wear more eyeliner than the members of the Cure. That's in the Guinness Book. But if you go back to the mists of time to 2008, I know it's very long ago. It's when a moderate president was a liberal senator. But in 2008, after 2 decades of image rehabilitation and all the secret negotiations and deals with oil, and, Gaddafi paid off the $1.5 billion in compensation funds for the victims' families, Bush called him on the phone, Condoleezza Rice went over to meet him, the UN lifted all their sanctions, and President Bush signed an executive order that gave Libya immunity from any terror-related lawsuits. So more or less let him off the hook. And this was part of the deal that involved Scotland freeing the Lockerbie bomber. I never get the guy's name right. Abdelbaset al-Megrahi, I think is his name.
Uh-huh.
And when Scotland released, you know, him, everyone went crazy for a few minutes because a lot of Republicans wanted to rename Haggis Freedom Entrails. and now, you know, we're 2.5 years later after Bush's great move of normalizing relations with Libya. And look what we got. Look where we're at. And no one wants to talk about the fact that it was a Republican administration that made this monster our ally.
Right.
And then when he went and did what he did. So, you know, liberals are really split on Libya, and it's fascinating watching. It is a cute coincidence that March 19th was the day we began bombing because it was the 8th anniversary of Iraq. And a lot of the protests, people came out for Iraq stock to protest on March 19th, as they always do. And then you had your Libyan protesters trying to glam on to the Iraq protest.
Right.
And some of the Iraq protesters support what's going on in Libya. Bishop
right.
Tutu supports what's going on in Libya.
Yep.
So you've got your protesters protesting at the protest because these other protesters are protesting at their protest.
Right.
And it all collapsed into a vortex of Noam Chomsky quotes and hemp fiber.
Let's take a break real quick on that note, because that's such a mental image. I'm starting to get a nosebleed, but that can be patched with patchouli oil. I'll be fine. John Fugelsang is on with us, and you can stick around for another segment with us.
Yeah, sure.
Great, fantastic. We'll be back after this. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
This is a disgusting display.
Boy, you can say that again.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show, where Tony is going out with a bang this week. Tony gets to pick our music and play what he likes while I'm in town, and it's a good feeling. You can tell he's just going for broke. And I want to thank John Fugelsang for joining us again for another segment. There is all this back and forth, John, about Gaddafi's gold. Well, you mentioned the fine that he supposedly paid, $1.5 billion, that he also got back in some sort of military reimbursement during the Bush years. He got $1.3 billion when he kind of came under the wing of the Bush administration.
And that would be oil supply in Darfur.
Yeah, totally. And right now there's a report in the Financial Times of and many other places, despite crippling sanctions and an arms embargo approved by the international community, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi continues to show resistance, and the possible reason for such confidence could be the 144 tons of gold that he still controls. Financial Times reported that the Libyan Central Bank, which is under Gaddafi's control, has about 143.8 tons of gold, according to the IMF. The gold at current price is worth $6 to $7 billion, enough to support a band of mercenaries for years. Which, by the way, does it bug you that they keep referring to the people who are supporting him as loyalists when he's paying them in American currency and gold to make them fight for him?
Well, I'm afraid the phrase "hired thugs" has been taken out by teachers unions in Wisconsin.
That's true.
If you watch
right.
the media, but
excellent
yeah, so
point.
Thugs are teachers unions, and
all the thugs are in Wisconsin.
Thugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm more disturbed by Admiral Mullen saying that at the end of this, Gaddafi could just remain in power. You know, the UN came out this week and said that regime change is not their goal with this operation. So what this means is that this guy could just stay in power somehow. He thinks he's got his job for life, then he finally loses it, and then he still gets to keep it after all the suffering he's caused. And the only other man to pull that off is Jay Leno?
Yeah, right. Well, for the record, I think under the mandate, they can't actually go for regime change, whether they want to say they would or not. They can't. If they say it, that changes the legal justification for what's going on, and
mm-hmm.
and it counts as sort of a broad-based version of extrajudicial assassination of a foreign leader. So they have to just go, we're just there to support the rebels and give them, and take down the Air Force so that he can't straight bomb them. That's what we were there for. They can't ever actually say even if it was their plan all along, that they want to, drop a bunker buster right on his cute little turban, his little
Indeed.
Hat, his little Eddie Murphy golden child hat that he wears.
It's it's good business, you know, and it's just them saying that we're not trying to bring about regime change. We're trying to stop him from slaughtering the protesters, and that is the window that will allow them to do whatever they want.
Exactly.
If they can. We'll see how it works when they hand it off to NATO, if the U.S. hands it off to NATO in a couple of days.
Right. Well, I think I got to say, judging from the look on Barack Obama's face when he has his press conferences about this versus the look that was on Bush's face when he had similar press conferences,
mm-hmm.
the twinkly elf-like glee that that Bush had every time he talked about every potential they could have for bombing another country, Obama doesn't seem to have that. He seems irritated that they have to be there. And I find that very reassuring, actually, because he doesn't seem like this, you know, we'll be there as long as it takes because America, you know, we got to do a trick for blah, 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 like this, you know, you don't hear any of that positive, like, we're only going to be there for 5 days. If we're there for 6 days, I'm going to be pissed, seems to be the language coming out of this White House.
Yeah, I think he's mad that Bush got Shock and Awe and he got Operation Odyssey Dawn.
Right, which is an ABBA song, isn't it?
Well, keen observers will note that that was the Little Scene Xanadu sequel, featuring music by Jeff Lynne and ELO and the lady who sang with Tony Orlando.
Right.
And, you know, you got to feel, Operation Odyssey Dawn, is this the Pentagon just trying to humiliate the president?
I think that was a UN choice. I think that translates to other languages better. I think in French, that sounds awesome.
Mm, it is the worst title since Operation Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which was pretty bad.
totally was.
You guys, you know, Desert Storm is vague but imposing, and Odyssey Dawn is with lemon fresh scent. So,
it's stunning. And here's, I guess, the big question for you, John Fugelsang. Is there a way that the Republicans can grasp onto this nonsense that they've been spewing and turn it into something positive for 2012? Because you have literally Bachman coming out. Explain to me how the first two people out of the box with exploratory committees are Bachman and Pawlenty, Teapaw. And officially the first GOP candidate for 2012 is gay and doesn't like Sarah Palin. His name is Fred Karger, and he's he's actually the first Republican to say he's going to run. In a minute, tell me how this field is going to look during a debate, if there is one.
Well, it's going to be great because you're leaving out that, you know, Newt Gingrich is only running for higher public speaking fees. Herman Cain is only running to make Michelle Bachman give back the crazy bread he took from his pizza store. Tim Pawlenty is really the best chance to get an endorsement deal from Ambien out of this. And it's going to be mitts to blow. I don't see how it's not going to be Romney Rubio in 2012. And the Republican Party will nominate another guy they hate.
Right.
Bachman is making it safe. The comedians of the world got to exhale yesterday when she did that.
It's going to be beautiful. Thank you so much, John Fugelsang, for joining us at John Fugelsang on the Twitter and on the Facebook. Find him. We'll talk to you again very soon, sir. Thanks very
Always
much.
A pleasure. Take
Cheers.
Care.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. We're in the last half hour of the show, and I want to thank Tony for making this a more than tolerable week. It's always a great time to hang out with Tony and try to one-up each other on obscure rock and gear. If you think we nerd out about music, you should hear us talk about microphones and mixing boards. It's a bit rough. And thanks to the folks at Steez for keeping me awake on my long drive from Las Vegas last night, after, two people in my audience were accosted by Vince Neil. I had to hop in my car and drive all the way to LA and drove straight through, came straight to the station after doing a show last night at 10 o'clock. And I have work to do this afternoon, and then I fly back to Vegas at 7, and then I go on stage at 10, and then I have radio tomorrow morning early. Tomorrow afternoon, at some point, I will enter a coma that will last 6 hours long, and then I'll have to do a show tomorrow night. I will make it. It's going to happen. But I want to thank you guys in the chat room, too, at HowlSparks.com, who've been having a great conversation, contentious at times, but always important. And thanks to the folks at Honda Power Sports, I can't wait for the weather to get better so that I can ride my motorcycle. I'm riding the Honda Fury these days. It's the 2011. Look it up. look at the orange one. It's so gorgeous. And so thanks to them for that as well. And Threadless, I'm wearing my actually, the shirt I'm wearing today is one of my concert shirts that I wear live, but I've been wearing Threadless all week, and it's been a great time. Okay, so now back to our calls. Let's take care of this. Let's go to Harold in Asheville, North Carolina.
Hey, how's it going, man?
It goes well. You know what Odyssey Dawn means? No, tell me.
Oh, well, shoot. That's too bad. You know the Operation Commando Eagle?
Sure, right. Yes, we have.
You know the Eagle without any shorts on?
Yes, Eagle without any underpants. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I dissected this one. Odyssey Dawn?
Yep.
Well, Odyssey means a long trip.
Yes.
And Dawn means the start of.
Oh, right. So we're entering into a long quagmire in the...
I mean, they're telling us. These guys are telling us what the hell we're doing.
What the goal is?
It's so stupid we don't understand it.
That's an excellent point and a point of concern. Let's go to Judy in Walnut Creek. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you. I've certainly enjoyed the presence of a wizard this morning.
Oh, well.
That's you, Hal. And I want to tell you, you are aptly named. Hal,
yes.
Go ahead and take over the world.
Right.
And Sparks.
Uh-huh.
I consider you friendly brilliance. I love your adeptness in the English language.
Thanks.
And incidentally, this Odyssey Dawn,
yeah.
I think it can mean this. It's the dawn of recognition that we've been on a very long odyssey, and we're going to throw new light on it. Because we are living in cataclysmically, everything that ever was is being thrown up into the air again.
Right.
Well, packaging the energy of this, and language is my expertise in that, and yours as well.
Yeah.
Also, I'm babbling because I'm trying to save you time.
No worries.
I want to remember the man that called in and was a little perturbed with you because you didn't get what he was saying about the Congress and Bush on the war.
Right.
I think he was alluding to a vote that was taken because wasn't there something in the campaigning where Hillary was being held accountable because she voted against it or for it or something. Now she changed her mind.
Right.
I think he was referencing that, and it didn't.
Well, the issue was that they were, they had to go along with this. He had to get permission for use of force in regard to the UN, sort of police action. You know, this idea that they were gonna go get a vote from the UN and we're gonna do it the right way. And
right.
All you have to do is give me the permission that if we get permission from the UN to use force, we'll do it. And then they went and BS'd the UN with Colin Powell and created false evidence and then use the authorization of force a way they weren't supposed to. Basically, they were given they went and got permission before they, under the pretense that we don't want to use this, it's the last resort, but we may have to. So before I go to the UN, you guys got to give me permission to do whatever the UN says I can do. And then we went and lied to the UN. And falsified information, used forged documents about yellow cake, uranium, that, which was the beginning of the whole Valerie Plame incident. And then the Downing Street memo comes out that says that, that he and Blair colluded basically to falsify evidence to make it look like Iraq was an imminent threat when they were not. They gave that same evidence to Congress, talking them into, okay, I need this permission to use force. And that was supposed to be in line with, almost a method of war that was almost archaic by Bush standards, that they were going to, he's not going to just rush in there roughshod and just start bombing the place. He's going to go through the process. I mean, he's silly, but he's not crazy. And then it turned out, oh, he's not doing any of this. This is Cheney, and Cheney is crazy. And so they had to go. The biggest question was not, would you vote for an authorization of force against someone like Saddam Hussein who had weapons of mass destruction, which is a legitimate conversation. The question largely became, I think, to a lot of progressives was, were you so stupid that you actually believed the line the Bush administration was telling you when they said they would only use this force in, as a last resort? They were not defending whether or not they would defend the nation against somebody with WMDs. To a lot of people, they were defending the fact that a lot of people were going, you didn't actually believe this idiot, did you? That was the lack of judgment.
Well, the shock doctrine has been very effective, and now we are in desperation because so much is coming at everyone. But I think it's if you put it in the frame of energy, this is about how we're packaging energy, whether it's to produce heat and all that stuff, or whether it is within ourselves with our emotions and
right.
how our own energy functions.
And how much waste is put off by the energy? How much waste is put off by the energy we use? I think that's another good analogy emotionally as well.
We're just like those rods you were describing,
right.
the guts of a nuclear. We are like that too with each other.
Yeah, you just put us next to each other and things start to heat up and nothing actually
that's
comes from it
right.
other than old-fashioned steam.
That's right. You're
right.
brilliant.
No, thank you. As are you. And it takes one to know one, Judy. And I thank you for being a critical thinker.
Thank you for bringing that up, because as a retired educator, people throw that terminology around, and what they don't understand is it's really a process of digestion.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, how am I receiving this? And it's like, oh, I don't like that. And it's like, oh, well, I have an attitude.
Uh-huh.
And examining my own attitude, that I see that I'm standing in a place and something's been thrown at me that suggests that there is another place to stand. I have to process that.
Right.
So it's really like digestion. It isn't all that complicated.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Judy. I appreciate it. That's what we need to do. Let's go to, before we go to the break, it's Greg Alexander. Everybody, big hand for Greg Alexander joining us from WCPT Radio, Chicago's Progressive Talk.
Good morning, Hal Spark.
Hello, Greg Alexander.
I agree with the lady before.
Last time
You're
caller,
really
first time listener.
Words and stuff.
Yeah, you think I'm good with the words?
The words and the sentences. You're good with all these things.
Thank you, yes. I think
Odyssey Dawn is either a video game, a feminine hygiene product, or a stripper's name.
Right, that's true.
And I would like to know, what does it mean in French? Have we found out yet?
And I have to say, it may be German that they used it in. Maybe in German it sounds really macho.
Sounds very macho.
We have to, yeah. Somebody needs to look up in the chat room, find out. And by the way, you're getting huge rounds of applause, both for you and the station in the chat room at HowlSparks.com. And on
say woohoo.
Yes, and on the HowlSparks iPhone app, which you can watch the show on and join the chat through, if I do say so my damn self.
Yes, you should.
Greg, we will be talking about a lot of these issues tomorrow. On my show on Saturdays, which is 9 to 11 Pacific and 11 to 2 Central, or 11 to 1 Central, you've got to be having a lot of fun watching all this nonsense.
I'm amazed at how Japan just kind of disappeared.
Yeah.
Remember that thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, unless you live in the Pacific Northwest where everyone is wearing hazmat suits to go to the grocery store.
I think CNN just kind of got bored with the whole hurricane, tsunami, nuclear
Absolutely.
Reactor thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they got bored.
Well, it's because damage from a natural disaster is passive. They prefer active damage from strafe bombing and explosions.
That brings in the ratings.
Exactly. Way sexier. Big hand, everybody, to Greg Alexander. We will talk to you tomorrow on the show. You are a genius, and I'm so lucky to be working with you, my friend.
24 hours and 19 minutes.
Always counting down. Always counting down. Thanks, Greg.
Rock on, brother.
Bye. Just an amazing dude. Let's go to Vaughn in Dublin, California. Hey, Vaughn.
Hi. A lot of people talk about electric cars.
I do.
We'd be better off electrifying the railroads first.
I completely agree. As a Californian, I'm actually quite happy that Scott Walker and the governor of Florida have been kicking back a lot of their high-speed rail funds, because that just means California is going to get maglev trains that much quicker.
They're not maglev, they're electric.
Right.
Steel wheel, steel rail.
Right, but one of the ones they're trying to build on the Irvine in California to Las Vegas one is a Chinese development company putting $9 billion in, and they're one of their plans to float is a maglev.
Yeah, that's way out there, but it uses a lot more energy than regular rail.
Right.
But the point with the freight railroads is the technology has existed for 100 years. It's
right.
all over the world. It would immediately drop the price of gas because the future demand, the futures market would see the demand drop instantly for, 7.5 billion gallons of diesel every year.
Yeah.
Also, diesel is the same distillate level as heating oil, so home heating oil would go down also.
Mm-hmm.
And the efficiencies would draw the diesel trucks off the road, so you get more road capacity. The thing with snow,
and less, by the way, unless road damage, unless
yeah.
road damage, and roads are made from asphalt,
exactly.
which is an oil
exactly.
process, right?
And we'd be that's imported oil most of it, even
yeah.
if it is from Canada or South America, but
yeah,
I mean, We could do that. I mean, that's a doable thing that anybody could do. It's construction jobs, tons of them.
Right.
Everything. It's secondary jobs for making steel and support poles and the electronics and the control systems and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And if you'd, but if you listen to Glenn Beck, he makes fun of us for wanting choo-choo trains like it's a big toy. That's, I mean, and that's what you're up against in this instead of a legit conversation about how beneficial it would be. You've got Scott Walker literally turning down train funds for just the sheer fact that they hate them. Meanwhile, the Atlas Shrugged movie is coming out, and it basically looks like an ad for high-speed rail.
It was originally a railroad guy in the control anyways. Most of the railroad guys are Republicans.
They exactly.
The money for sure.
Yeah, the ironic part is not anymore. Thanks so much for the call, Vaughn. We got to take a break. We're running up against the last bottom. We got two more calls who are in there, but 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We will take your calls into the end, and we will have our final happy ending of the week. So exciting. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show.
Join the party. 1-800-STEP-12.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks and enjoying the joy of coming back from a break to one of my own songs. This is 01, My Pretty Parasite. Yeah. We played that last Monday at the Whiskey with Malice and Annie Cruz and a girl named Allison go-go dancing on stage with us. Good times. I'm going to say it was a great time. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We're in the last little bit of this, and I really want to talk to let's go to Charles first in L.A. Hey, Charles.
Yes.
Thanks for hanging on.
Thank you. So there was no oil in Bosnia or Kosovo. We went in there to stop a genocide, but we didn't go into Darfur, Sudan. We didn't go into Rwanda
right.
to stop genocide. Well, what's the big difference there?
Well, I think part of it's coalition. I think part of it's closeness to European neighbors. I think there's, you know, Bosnia and Kosovo being kind of right on the edge of a couple of other countries that got very nervous about the sprawl of that conflict, and then it was specific ethnic cleansing that was right knocking on their door. That's probably why they used it as an excuse. I do think it was about skin color. Myself, and mm-hmm. you know, and I do think the world abdicated its responsibility in Africa specifically, and I think partly there's a soft racism that was about that, which is they just feel distant and not connected to that part of the world, and I think there's another group of people that view ethnic cleansing in that part of the world as thinning out an area that's very resource rich. They can come in and get the stuff later. I, like many people, was horrified about our lack of action in that. But our lack of action in Darfur doesn't mean don't go into Bosnia Herzegovina. So, you know what I mean?
I agree, and I appreciate your honesty on that.
Absolutely. I was very, you know, I think a lot of us carry around the guilt of that, and I think that to some degree, you look at the Libyan situation, I think that's why there's a lot of variant attitude about it on the progressive side, that we do carry around the damage from that, you know, that's a scar on progressives and on liberals, you know, that, you know, we had a Democrat in office and we had a lot, you know, a lot of warning about this, a lot of new information about this, and people just turned their back. And like I said, I think that's the danger of soft racism more than direct racism. Direct racism, you can almost confront and call out. But soft racism is when people just kind of turn their back and pretend it's not happening because they don't want a part of it or don't feel connected
yeah,
to the.
Or just say, oh, what a shame. And
yeah,
do nothing.
And do nothing. Right. Exactly.
Obama, I think he's it's a bad situation, but I think he handled it right. He got our people out of there first.
Yep.
He froze the assets, got the Arab League and the United Nations to go along with the plan, and then he went to work. And he did talk to congressional people beforehand.
He did. You're absolutely right. He talked to congressional leaders about this. He got basically tacit approval from them, which he didn't need because of the precedent established since 1945. He's got the ability to do this for up to 60 days without having to go to them that's the thing about having a standing army. If you got a problem with having a standing army, then we can really talk about the ability or not ability to do actions like this, because that's what this is really about. But I think you're absolutely right.
Yes, and now the latest thing I've heard is the regime and the rebels are planning a meet, so maybe they'll come up with something.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I don't know how they do that, because all the quote-unquote loyalists, for the most part, are you know, mercenaries paid for by, you know, that Gaddafi has hired. They have a job to do. Maybe there's a meeting with the rebels going, there'll be more money on our side if you can go down swinging with him. But we've got the backing of the UN, and they're going to come in and give us some remake money. And if you go, turn on him, I'll pay you double. You know, it's the old, you know, Steve Martin and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. What's he paying you? I'll double it, and we'll kick the crap out of him. Thanks a lot, Charles. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Mark in Bakersfield. We've only got a couple minutes left. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing, pal?
I'm great.
Did you see Michael Steele last night on Hardball?
No. I have to say, it's hard for me to watch Michael Steele because my giggle reflex gets too high. Because I don't know if he's a cartoon character from The Simpsons, or he's like, he seems made up to me because he's so ridiculous. But go ahead.
Well, the verbal mid-air twist he did when trying to answer the question about Newt Gingrich's flip-flop
right.
would put Circus du Soleil to shame.
Absolutely. We played some of that clip yesterday. Basically, Newt Gingrich has made no definable statement on Libya at all. It is just it's that old Groucho Marx line, whatever it is, I'm against it. Whatever you come up with, President Obama, I'm just going to say the opposite just because I hate you, not because I'm thinking this through, not because it really matters. There's plenty of precedents on both sides. I can figure out the language later. And his Twitters to follow up and try to paint plaster the holes in what he said are even more just straight gibberish, because there's nothing. An indefensible position is hilarious, but an indefensible position done in shorthand in 140 characters or less is ridiculous.
And it's the same thing when they tried to defend Michelle Bachmann's speeches, and they know what they're saying, they don't believe it at all.
Oh, right.
But they have to do it because they're Republicans.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the call. We're up against the bottom of the show, Mark. Thanks, everybody, this week. Thanks, Miranda, for arranging all the guests and dealing with that stuff. Thanks to all the regulars who came in, Carl Frisch and John Fugelsang and the like, and Rick Overton for joining us. Thanks, Tony Sorrentino, for getting up at a ridiculous hour. Thanks. Look, we have news coming in. It's fantastic. And thanks to everybody on the Ustream feed. We will be streaming the show tomorrow. Please join us in the chat room there. We will continue a lot of this conversation. I want to end with a happy ending. I mean, I think in the lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to reinvent the fuel business, engineers at a biofuel startup called Joule Unlimited tinker with tiny life forms all day. And the 4-year-old startup is on the front lines of branching biotechnology that taps into a wealth of knowledge from genome. They have created what may be the perfect microbe that creates biofuel and its waste. All you got to do is feed it sugars and crap and garbage, and it will crank out a biofuel you can actually use. No digging it up. It's not under other countries. This little bug is going to be able to... I think it's fantastic. And P.S. We don't have time for that. There's too much good news for that. But I just want to leave that out there. That bacteria, stuff that's all over your skin, all over your food, all over your water, all the time, will be probably the source of energy for us that gets our cars rolling very soon. And I think that's very positive. I'm always a big fan of goo. And that's our happy ending for today. Thanks again, everybody. Tune in. Steph will be back on Monday, and I'll be here for Hump Days next week. If I can absolutely make it. But thanks again. It's been the Stephanie Miller Show. Have a great weekend, everybody.